Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Leviathan Song by Elsie Winters, narrated by Maeve York. Chapter 1. The bell ringing over the door made me grit my teeth in frustration. All I wanted was to focus on the project at my fingertips and ignore the world outside for a little while longer. If I'd been paying attention, it wouldn't have caught me unaware, because the man entering had just enough magic for me to feel him coming from outside the shop. I had a habit of blocking that extra perception out when I worked, since Sydney usually dealt with the customers. I preferred to hide away and lose myself in my projects. Today, that was impossible, so, with resignation, I set down my current piece, a jewel made to look like a wasp. I couldn't get it working yet anyway.
Ilara, just the person I wanted to see.
I masked a grimace, wishing I could say the same. Val Harrington stalked across the entrance of my shop and pressed his meaty hands to the glass case in front of me. He was a paunchy, mid-level professor of archaeology and fancied himself some kind of Indiana Jones. His magical ability was dowsing, finding things underground like water or minerals or fossils, and gave me the faintest impression of a scavenger following a scent through subterranean caverns. My magical gift, one of the two, allowed me to suss out the nature of people's magical abilities. My other magical gift, passed down by my father, allowed me to create magical objects, which was probably why he was here in my shop, Northern Charm. "How can I help you, Mr. Harrington?" I plastered a smile on my face and braced myself for the inevitable conversation about how he had trapped and killed a dragon in the Boundlands 20 years ago. Never mind that it had been hibernating and being over 10,000 years old, so decrepit that the majority of its scales were missing. It hadn't even had any teeth left, but Harrington was a hero in his own mind. Anyone who disagreed would be talked over with tales of his trophy hunt of a lifetime, though it had been so large that Harrington and his men couldn't get it out of the mountain cave. They had taken only a single horn, and bringing it down the mountain had nearly cost one of the men's lives when the group fell during descent. The great beast's body had lain up in the mountain for the last 20 years, fouling up the passageway while Harrington blathered on about it to anyone with ears.
"I have a fantastic business opportunity for you," he said. His voice was booming, too loud for the small indoor space. "I just saw Sydney, and I told her to put in an order with you. I killed a dragon, you know."
Here we go.
"I bet you could make a golem out of the bones still up in that cave."
I choked. Technically, I could make a golem, an artificial construct magically animated with a heartstone, out of bones. But the idea turned my stomach. It was too close to necromancy.
"If you can't do that," he said, responding to my reaction, "I will take a stone golem instead. Sydney wasn't inclined to pass along my order since I don't have a heartstone. I can't understand why you have someone like that working for you."
My expression hardened. I didn't like anyone disparaging my friends. "I'm sorry you felt dismissed," I hedged. "But Sydney knows my policies. I insist clients provide certified heartstones up front, because they are prohibitively expensive and difficult to procure. The only way to get one was to trade something of value to the little fairy folk, unless you wanted to deal with the Kelpies, and no one dealt with the Kelpies. The fairies themselves were nearly impossible to barter with, not to mention terrifying. The water fairies, or sprites as they were known, had huge, luminous eyes and needle-like teeth. They left vicious bites when angered and rarely came to the surface for trade anyway. The fire fairies were basically born of hot coals and seething rage. Bargaining with them was like trying to bargain with a nest of angry hornets. Sparks were said to have the shortest tempers of all the fae, and anyone known for trading with them was bound to be covered in disfiguring scars. In fact, the only fairies who resembled the cutesy darlings of folklore were the pixies from the woodlands, and even they could leave a nasty bite. It was risky business to bargain with the fae. After one of them suggested bartering a human child in exchange for a heartstone, I'd cut off trading with them altogether. Now, I insisted on my clients producing their own heartstone first, with a certified receipt detailing exactly what it was traded for. Not to mention, I continued, that a golem's entire being is designed around the type of heartstone that drives it. A spark stone would need to power a creation of lava rock and fire. If a client wanted a fire golem and then later was only able to procure a stone from a pixie, my work would be worthless, an empty husk. I'd have to start again. That's why I require a heartstone and a substantial down payment up front. And because of this, I don't make many golems. It's not really the type of work I'm interested in pursuing. And that was fine with me. The task of building them was fraught with ethical quandaries and stacks of legal documents, and I tended to be suspicious of those requesting one anyway. Especially Val Harrington. "What is your purpose for needing a golem?" I asked.
"A down payment!"
he sputtered, looking horrified.
"This is an opportunity! Imagine how much interest you would get from people wanting to do business with you when I tell them you made it for me. You wouldn't have to waste your time peddling these little trinkets anymore."
He gestured to the cases of magical amulets, jewelry, and knives surrounding him that I'd poured hours of my time and energy into. I made a good living and got to work on new projects every day, so to have him dismiss my work as merely trinkets was incredibly insulting.
"For your information," he continued haughtily, "I need a golem to help care for my father. He's ailing, you know."
My expression hardened further, and I chose to dismiss that last bit as I knew his family. His father had passed away when I was a child. "I like what I do, Mr. Harrington, and I'm truly not interested in creating golems, stone or otherwise."
"You elves are all the same, keeping your magic to yourselves and refusing to share it with other people."
He whirled on his heel and stomped from the store, trying and failing to slam the door behind him, since it worked on a self-closing hinge. I blew out an angry breath and shook my head, making the tiny chains woven into my hair jingle, then turned to sigh at my bejeweled insect. My groan was audible when the bell chimed again, but relief filled me when my best friend swept in. Today, her long blonde hair was pulled back in its usual ponytail, with several braids woven in. She was stunning, with her high cheekbones, pointed chin, and darker eyebrows and dark blue eyes that contrasted against pale skin. She was muscular for a woman, and with her height and strong frame, she always reminded me of some kind of warrior princess reincarnated from eons past.
"Was that little weasel coming from here?" Sydney asked, pointing toward the door. "I told him to get lost when he tried to corner me at the warehouse. He must have slipped out while I was still haggling and come here to pester you instead."
We were opposites in both appearance and attitude. Sydney was a magpie shifter, and everything you might imagine a Corvid's personality to be. Coarse, gregarious, and fun. She was built like a Nordic warrior, generally flippant and self-assured. I was absolutely none of those things. But
Once she'd seen me accidentally destroy half a building in college, well, she decided immediately that I was her new friend, and we'd become just that. Because we both shared an interest in magical items, though hers ran more to knives and weaponry, she'd come up with the idea to open a shop together in one of the less expensive districts in Seattle. We both procured supplies and items of interest, but Sydney spent most of her time dealing with customers and bookkeeping. That left me free to tinker and build, supplying our shop with finished items. This morning, she had an appointment with a dealer and had left me to cover the shop by myself.
"Sorry I took so long,"
Sydney grumbled, dropping her backpack with a loud thump and heading for the fridge in the back.
"You know how Mason Gentry likes to talk. I did find some nice daggers, though."
Her voice became muffled as she scavenged. Finally heading back my way with a carrot, she perched on the nearest counter with an odd expression.
"Did you hear about the Kelpie attacks?"
she asked with her mouth full.
"No," I replied, distracted by my unfinished project.
"Did you find my silver filament?"
"Sure did,"
she frowned, pulling a bundle from the pocket in the front of her hoodie and tossing it to me.
"What happened with the Kelpies?"
I ripped out the material I'd hoped to substitute for the silver, threaded the new filament through the back of the clasp on the tiny heartstone shard, then worked on attaching it to the wings.
"Gentry said he heard a lot of water sprites have gone missing from some of the trading outposts, and it turns out Kelpies have been eating them."
I dropped my pliers.
"Eating them?
Sprites are sentient people. That's disgusting." My stomach turned. That was one of the most disturbing things I'd heard in a long time. Sydney nodded clearly in agreement. Kelpies were known for using their magic to lure things and kill them. But the thought that they would be seeking out people to dine on regularly now was beyond the pale. Forcing my attention back to my project, I clipped off the filament. I focused on the heartstone, pushing my energy into it, and, perhaps some pent-up anger, willing it to life. Immediately, the wings began to flutter and it rose as if flying. It was actually levitating, but the fluttering wings added a nice touch, and it really did resemble a large wasp. It didn't have a purpose yet, but I'd think of something. I hadn't created something like it in a long time, and I was thrilled to get it off the ground. Hearing a scream morph into a screech, I turned in time to see Sydney disappear, her clothes a clump on the floor, the lump of her avian form hidden within.
"Sydney, you just watched me build it. It's not even real."
She fought her way free of the neck hole and flapped her wings angrily, squawking at me. Her sleek black and white form hopped to the countertop, and I scooped up her clothes and carried them to the back room so she'd have some privacy to dress once she calmed down. We really needed to work on her startle reflex. Stepping out into the crisp fall Seattle air, I scanned the street and made my way to the Golden Laurel Gate, heading home. Feeling the rings on my fingers and bracelets on my wrists, I made a mental tally of each magical item on my person, the way another girl might note the mace in her pocket or a whistle around her neck. I had amulets, charms, and talismans woven into my loose hair in tiny chains, draped from my neck and clustered in my pockets. I wasn't quite 5 feet tall, certainly wasn't strong, and had no defensive or offensive magic. But I had enough energy to power my stones, and they had some built-in surprises. I pulled my jacket a little tighter, thankful the weather where I lived in the Boundlands, known to some humans as fairy, matched up for now with the weather here in the Void, or the human realm. North Seattle made a great location for our shop, thanks to being a relatively large magical crossroads. There were enough people coming and going between the void and the Boundlands that we had 3 separate gates in this neighborhood alone. Seattle itself wasn't a great draw, but it was an important hub with lots of magical traffic and cheap rent, at least compared to the Boundlands. It was a logical midpoint to set up shop. As I neared the corner, I felt a spider web of sensation, a tingle along the outer reaches of my perception. I focused on the tugging sensation. Most people might have given in to it, being pulled under by the feelings of joy and gratitude. But I recognized it as an enchantment. I had a ward against such things, and while it wasn't perfect, it did its job. I continued forward, working my way through a gathering crowd and paying attention to the threads of enchantment. Sitting on a concrete ledge in front of the local coffee shop was a man playing guitar and singing about a January wedding. His guitar case was propped open and overflowing with bills from passersby and the gathered crowd. Tall and lanky, with a swimmer's build, he had loosely curled dark blonde hair and an angular jaw covered in light scruff. A tattoo sleeve of an ocean scene flowed up his left arm. He was breathtaking. As I came to a stop nearby, the man raised his eyes to meet mine, and a lazy grin spread across his face, making my heart race. He reminded me of Seafoam and the joy of looking for little treasures washed up in the surf. I tried to get a better feel for his magic, but what I got didn't make any sense. It felt like he was singing his enchantment, but the only spell singers I knew of were mermaids, and only the females were sirens. Male sirens didn't exist. Another oddity was that the regular run-of-the-mill humans around me appeared to be under his influence. Since they didn't have any magic of their own, our magic didn't usually affect them. Although there were stories in human folklore of sailors being lured by sirens, maybe they could be affected. There was also the possibility that he was just a good singer. His voice was warm and slightly husky, drawing you in, making you feel wanted, cherished. Singing, as he was, about weddings and love, about knowing his beloved even though she speaks so low that he could barely hear her. Yeah, it was easy to fantasize about being in love with this singer in another life. But looking at the small crowd, they all seemed excessively cheerful for people in this area. It wasn't called the Seattle Freeze for the weather, after all. Even as I stood there, several people approached and threw large bills in his case. People aren't this generous with buskers. There was more going on than just his singing ability. I narrowed my gaze as he finished his song, and people began to blink off their confusion and disperse. I bristled at their dazed expressions. Just like the Kelpies, this was one more example of sea folk using their lures to target vulnerable people.
"Hello, Empress,"
he continued, looking at me with that impish smile. He might recognize me as being, very distantly, related to the current ruling family within the Boundlands, but I'd never met this man before. I would have remembered him. "Empress?" I asked, my voice flat. He broke into a large grin, his teeth just this side of too sharp for a human. Merfolk supposedly had sharp teeth, similar to a water sprite, but I'd never met one myself.
"It seems fitting,"
he said, his light eyes assessing my form.
"You're wearing enough jewelry to finance an empire."
His eyes were warm as he said it, as if perhaps his teasing wasn't meant to be taken as mocking. I didn't know how to respond, so I simply asked the question on my mind. "What are you doing?" His smile dropped by a degree, and his eyes narrowed a fraction.
"What does it look like I'm doing?"
The crowd had dispersed, and being the focus of his attention made me feel as though a wave were crashing over me, pulling me toward him in a rising tide. A flush crept up my neck and into my cheeks.
"It looks like you're playing guitar on the sidewalk," I began, struggling to focus.
"But it feels like you're enchanting people."
"That doesn't make any sense, though,
because you're not a mermaid." The last bit was mostly muttered to myself.
"Last time I checked, that was correct,"
he replied with a smirk. If I narrowed my eyes at him any further, they would shut. This guy could weaponize his charm. He hesitated before seeming to catch himself, then leaned over, straightening the money in his case. Clearly a dismissal.
"Wouldn't that be stealing?"
I asked because I couldn't help myself. Everything about it felt wrong to me.
"Why?"
He sat back on his haunches and looked at me.
"Everything here is freely given. Performing is an art, and art makes people feel things. I can't help it if the words I speak affect people more than someone else's words. I have bills to pay, so I use what gifts I have at my disposal to make a living."
His eyes grew colder as he spoke, defensive and cautious.
"I don't suppose someone who comes from old money would know much about that, though."
I looked down at my clothing, a draping top, designer jeans, and a light peacoat.
"Why would you think that?"
"Lots of things, Empress. But your accent screams upper golden laurel."
He stuffed his cash into a cubby in his case and gently placed his guitar inside, nestling it carefully before closing the case.
"I'm not an empress," I muttered.
"Not yet."
He stood, his grin returning, and picked up his case.
"But if you work very hard, you might get there someday. Maybe this will help."
He pulled something out of his pocket and flicked it to me as he walked away. Catching the object out of the air, I opened my hand to reveal a quarter. Chapter 2. I was surprised as the week went on how many times the siren returned to my thoughts. While there were many men I found to be attractive, it was incredibly rare for me to feel attracted to someone, and I wondered if the frequency of my thoughts was simply that, attraction. When we discussed the encounter the next day, Sydney had been nearly hysterical at my retelling.
"Lord, Ilara, I can't believe he pegged your accent right down to the neighborhood,"
she'd said with a laugh.
"Only you would question the ethics of a siren singing on the street. It's not like he was luring sailors to a watery grave."
She had asked me multiple times why he'd given me a non-magical quarter, not understanding why he thought I might want human money, not understanding that it was meant as a taunt, and a well-deserved one at that. My face heated at the memory. I was more embarrassed every time my conversation with him mentally resurfaced. I jerked from my distraction when my name was called, stepping forward quickly to collect my coffee from the counter at the local Starbucks. Halfway to the door, I felt the siren's magic outside and froze. I briefly contemplated living in a coffee shop for the rest of my life. That was assuming he wasn't planning to come inside. The possibility of him finding me standing here like a deer in headlights had me glancing toward the bathroom. That was ridiculous, but I wasn't ready to see him again. I recognized that I'd still been irritated about Harrington's behavior toward me in my shop that day, and upset about the Kelpie attacks on the water sprites, and it had been unfair to direct those feelings toward him. He'd also been right that I didn't know anything about struggling to pay bills. I'd been born to a wealthy family in a wealthy area, and thanks to my father's abilities as an artificer and a golemancer, which he passed on to me, He'd never had difficulty securing contracts with the government in the Boundlands. The siren provided entertainment, and people willingly paid him for that service. No one was harmed by his manipulation, and if perhaps they were a bit more generous than they would have been otherwise, who was I to say what he was doing was wrong? I used my own magic to make a living for myself. Admittedly, I still had some quibbles about the way he was using his magical talents. But I also had concerns about the morals of the contracts my father took to make the money he'd provided for our family as well. I came to the conclusion, while staring into space, that I had indeed been too quick to judge him. I knew I needed to apologize, but that didn't mean I wanted to do it right now. Unfortunately, there wasn't a reasonable way for me to get back to my shop without him seeing me. I could feel him outside. Impressions of sand and surf, high tide and clear, starry nights rolling over me. Once I'd met someone and felt their magic, I could usually recognize them from a distance. Each person's unique combination of presence and magic stood apart to me from anyone else's, even if just slightly, like a scent or a taste. Feeling him out there and knowing that I was only delaying the inevitable, I made myself move. Forcing myself forward, I stepped out onto the patio as the wind lifted loose strands of my dark brunette hair around my face. Moving slowly to keep from jingling, I did my best not to draw attention. I found him, bent over a shaded table, writing on a sheet of paper with an empty cup near his hand. I realized I could walk past him, pretend like I hadn't seen him, but now that I had seen him, it felt inexplicably rude. While I despised inviting confrontation, I knew I'd offended him and my conscience wouldn't allow me to escape from apologizing now that I had the opportunity to do so. I hated this. Sydney would never fret over a conversation. She'd just stroll right up and say whatever she wanted to. I could be brave, right? I stilled near his table, unsure how to approach. Should I interrupt him? Wait for him to see me? I hadn't really thought this part through. I was half a second from chickening out and returning to hide in the store when he paused to brush his hair back from his face, spotting me out of the corner of his eye. Setting his pencil down, he turned toward me, eyebrows pulling together and one side of his lip quirked up. I probably looked like a squirrel caught raiding the birdseed with my eyes wide and my hands clutching my coffee beneath my chest. His grin widened. Empress? Siren? Are you just going to stalk me, or would you like to sit? He asked, making me sputter. He laughed lightly, his eyes shining in amusement. I'm not stalking you. I wanted to apologize, I said, mortified. He gestured at the chair across from him, obviously seeing my slight horror. I promise I don't bite, he murmured. My gaze jumped to his slightly too sharp teeth, though I knew he meant it jokingly. You really want me to sit? I asked, stalling. I looked toward my shop, briefly wondering how awkward it would be for me to simply dart away. Pretty awkward. Only my years of ingrained composure training rooted me to the paving stones. I didn't like how flustered looking at him made me feel. He was too pretty to focus on. His angular jawline framed generous, soft-looking lips, and high cheekbones highlighted a straight nose. Full, sweeping eyelashes surrounded piercing, clear blue eyes. When factored in with his enchantments tugging at me this way and that, I knew I was bound to embarrass myself again. Sit. He nodded at the chair and pushed it out with his foot, staring at me like he had guessed my plan to bolt. I hesitated. Can you turn it off? I asked, creeping slowly around the table. The curve of his mouth dipped down into a frown, his eyebrows drawing low. Turn what off? You know. I waved my hand around in the air near my head.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?